Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women over 50 across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. I'm truly delighted to be interviewing Jill Pay today. Jill was appointed as the first female Sergeant at Arms in the UK House of Commons in 2008, a formal job with a very formal uniform. Her responsibilities as Sergeant were security, access, and ceremonial, and she loved every moment of it until she retired in the spring of 2012. A quote from her leaving tribute reads, "Jill has also played a powerful role in mentoring and encouraging other women in the House Service to achieve their potential. The number of women now occupying senior posts in the House Service is some measure of the example she has set." Jill's passion is to help people to develop, grow, and succeed. From primary school children who are struggling to learn to read, through to entrepreneurs finding their way in business and female senior managers who are seeking to crack that ultimate glass ceiling to join the board. She is a trustee of the Beanstalk Literacy Charity that seeks to improve literacy in primary schools across the UK, and she is a founder and active member of the Pink Shoe Club, a business women's network affiliated to UK Parliament that recognises, develops and celebrates women's unique talents and skills that complement those of their male colleagues. Jill is chairman of the Pink Shoe Senate, a strategic planning group that seeks to drive the organisation forward to benefit women and men across the world. Jill, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to be interviewing you. I loved the photo that you sent me to put up on the website of you in that very formal and magnificent uniform with you, what is it called?
It's called the mace.
The mace.
Yes.
What a photograph that was.
Well, that was the full bling day.
Wow.
I mean, although I wore the formal Georgian court dress-based uniform every day, that was taken on state opening day. So the Queen comes in all her glory and everybody in the house wears their glory as well. But it was pretty special.
I mean, it's something that we do so well in this country, isn't it? That formal circumstance and the uniform and that tradition, and we are hard to beat, I think, across the world for something like that.
That's right,
it's
yes,
fabulous.
That's right.
So how did you get to have that role as Sergeant at Arms?
Well, I'd worked in the house. I first went there in 1994 as what they called the head office keeper, but in commercial terms, we'd call it the facilities manager.
Right.
And that was a great first job because I had to know the whole parliamentary estate, all the buildings, met lots of people across the house's own administration, but met members as well. So I was in charge of all the front of house services, cleaning, photocopying, but you know, the people who did it were really my main ownership, if you like. And I did that job for 5 years, and then again I was the first woman to have that job.
Were you?
And I was also the first woman to have brought in from outside the house.
Were you? Oh my gosh.
So the then sergeant had the vision that they needed to become more customer focused, and they needed to bridge the gap between senior management and the staff, because at that time there was nothing in between. So they wanted somebody who'd managed change, who was customer focused, who'd got some management experience. And after a very long interviewing and presentations and meeting people process, I got that job, and I did that for 5 years. And then I was given the project to open Portcullis House, Parliamentary building, which was amazing.
Yeah.
I never worked so hard in my whole life. You know,
gosh,
12-hour days, weekends, but it was really rewarding. And I was there, you know, hard hat and boots and up the scaffolding,
goodness
showing
me
members around, right through to the occupation. And I think 210 members and their staff moved in, and we bespoked every office to meet their style of working and what they wanted. So it was a wow. And the last part of it was to organise the official opening by Her Majesty the Queen. That was in February 2001.
Wow.
So that was an amazing project.
Incredible.
But it finished. That was it. Yeah. So then there'd been a big management investigation of how the house was run, and there was restructuring. And the Sergeant at Arms, it was decided, had such a portfolio of responsibility, they needed an executive officer. And so I went and was the executive officer to the sergeant. So that's when I started working very closely in the area of the Sergeant at Arms. There's five. There were five sergeants.
Oh,
then.
Really?
Okay. And I was executive officer to the sergeant. And then the middle sergeant announced he was going to retire. And I was encouraged to apply for that job. And that was an internal competition.
Right.
So it wasn't quite so challenging. And I got it and actually leapfrogged two men who'd been my bosses, which was pretty good. And they were great. They were very generous and they were fine about it. And I did that for 3.5 years. And then the then sergeant announced he was going to retire, and didn't cross my mind to apply for the job. Really didn't.
Were you encouraged to do so then?
Fantastic. I was.
By the sergeant who was retiring?
Oh, by all sorts of people, yes. Okay. By him, but by and senior women, you know.
Fantastic.
In the House of Commons, there's very few senior women.
Yeah.
And they tend to support each other, which is great.
Fantastic.
So they encouraged me as well. So I thought, what have I got to lose? So I did, but that was an external competition as well.
Was it?
And headhunters and all sorts of things. Anyway, got through it to the last two, which was me and a brigadier. And so somebody had to make the decision,
wow.
And all my predecessors were ex-military.
I was going to ask you what the criteria.
So they'd all been ex-military sort of end of career appointments. And somebody decided that they wanted somebody who was more customer focused, had a different style. My style was very much to facilitate members' work rather than be a yes-no policeman, which... historically, that had rather been the image.
Okay.
Anyway, it got down to the last two, and we were both interviewed by the Speaker, and then he made a recommendation to the Queen, because it is a royal appointment.
Oh, is it?
And
right.
Yeah, and he recommended me.
Fantastic.
And she accepted.
Fantastic.
And so I think I applied in the middle of September 2007 and was formally appointed on the 30th of January 2008.
Wow.
So that was quite a grueling period
absolutely.
Of time.
Absolutely. Yeah. How fantastic. So what exactly did your duties encompass?
The main responsibility was security.
Right.
So 80% of the job was being responsible to the Speaker for the security of the House of Commons, everybody who works there and everybody who visits.
Right.
And there's 1 million visitors a year. 3,500 people work on the parliamentary estate.
Amazing. It's like a village, isn't it?
And
it's incredible.
It is. And in that time of terrorist threat, the security was the huge part of the job.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a security person, but I had access to the best advice
right.
we could possibly have.
Right.
And the security operation in the house is run through the Met Police.
Yeah.
So it's a formal contract. So I was the contract owner for the House of Commons. Blackrod was the contract owner for the House of Lords, and that was a contract with the Metropolitan Police.
Oh, okay. So Sergeant Arms is the House of Commons, and
Blackrod's the House of Lords.
I always wondered what.
Yes,
because
we're often told
go into Blackrod's entrance, but I've never really been sure what.
And that's the House of Lords end.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
So the main part of the job was security,
right?
And then I would say probably 10% was ceremonial. And that was the part that you see. And that was the Speaker's procession every day, carrying the mace, leading the procession into the chamber, being in the sergeant's chair in the chamber for the first couple of hours of every day, and when there were peaks of business or particularly long sittings, which is why you have a number of sergeants.
I see.
So there's always one in the chair.
Right.
And wonderful days like state opening of Parliament and VIP visitors, and perhaps I'll say a bit more about them later. And then the other 10% was about access. So that was making sure that only the people you wanted to let into secure areas came into secure areas.
Okay.
So it was all the clearances, background checks, and a very technical access control system.
Gosh.
So I'd actually introduced that when I was assistant sergeant.
Yeah.
So it's all about access. So it's all about letting non-security cleared people only in public areas and security cleared people, making sure they're properly security cleared and they can go through to other areas. And that was all with a touch pass system.
Yeah.
And that also included the security of the chamber and committees and galleries around the chamber and galleries in committees.
Goodness
so that
me.
Was, there
that's,
was quite
that's some responsibility, Jill. Jeepers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it for a set period, or is it literally until you decide to step down?
No, mine was a permanent appointment. Right. There had been term appointments, and I'm not sure they'd worked particularly well. So, no, mine was a permanent appointment until I decided to retire.
So why did you decide to retire?
Well, I'd done it for 4 years, and it was a huge, huge responsibility. Mm. And I wanted to retire when I'd still got energy and enthusiasm yeah. to do other things.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd worked in the house for nearly 20 years altogether,
wow.
and 4 years as sergeant. And I was beginning to think, you know, do I really want to do this anymore? It was very demanding. On a Monday, I would start work at 8, never get home till after 11, work in the evenings. And because of the position, you were virtually always on call.
Yeah.
So I did have a wonderful residence on the parliamentary estate because you needed to be there yeah. in case there was any kind of incident.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I decided, you know, after careful thought, that I'd done my share, let's say. And I wanted to leave, you know, when I'd got all this energy and enthusiasm to do other things.
I can't remember who said it now, but it's something about always leave people wanting more. So
yes.
it's about knowing when to step
yes.
away, isn't it?
Yes,
and
it is.
Almost it's when you're at your peak is when you kind of step
yeah.
up, step
yeah.
away. Amazing. Yeah. Do you miss it?
No.
Fair enough.
I miss the people, but then the people that I was close to I still see.
Still see, yeah.
Yes, but
yeah.
no, I don't, because it was a little bit cyclical.
Okay.
You know, you'd have a general election,
yep,
another
yep.
5 years to have another one,
yeah.
and you'd have a state opening every year. And they yeah. were wonderful. I mean, I loved every minute of it. But it just became a little bit cyclical.
Okay.
And I wanted something that was not cyclical anymore.
Yeah, okay. And a bit more random.
Well, yes, and also to be doing what I wanted to do, not what other people wanted me to do.
Good point. Mm. Were you formally presented to the Queen?
No, not on my appointment.
Right.
But I met her several times during, the first time was when she came to open Portcullis House. And then I met her latterly. There was a big event in Westminster Hall to celebrate her Diamond Jubilee.
Ah.
And she came and received formal addresses from both Houses of Parliament. But as part of that, there was a gift to her personally from members of both houses, which was a beautiful stained glass window.
Mm.
And that was my last project,
How
which
fantastic.
Was lovely. So
How
I
fantastic.
Went back to this event after I'd actually retired.
Brilliant.
And there was a reception afterwards, a private reception, and I met her then. And then I met her again. I've been to garden parties as well, but that was sort of not so personal. I met her again when the stained glass window was actually put in position. It's if you imagine Westminster Hall,
mm-hmm.
and as you go in, you see a huge stained glass
mm-hmm.
window, and in the middle is her father's coat of arms.
Right.
And this one is above the north door.
Ah,
and that
look out
was
for it when I'm there.
And that the coat of arms, and it's a contemporary version of her own coat of
okay.
arms, is in the middle of that window. And it was put in when all the stonework was being cleaned, and so she came back to see it in position, and that was a very intimate Friday morning. About 30 of us met her and had chats with her then. So
I know you can't yeah. say much, but is she as lovely as she appears to be?
She's so special. She makes you feel as if you're the only person in the room.
That's a real gift, isn't
and
it?
That she's talked to you for about 5 minutes. It's probably been 30 seconds. Yeah, she is. And she's got beautiful skin. Yeah,
she's amazing.
Quite amazing.
And she's what, 90 this
she's
year?
She's 90 this
yeah,
year.
Yeah, I was reading this
yeah.
morning, actually, about her 90th
yes.
birthday celebration.
Yes.
I mean, amazing.
Mm.
Amazing. Okay, I interviewed somebody, I was just saying to you, interviewed somebody who's 95.
Yes.
I mean, just amazing. Mm. Incredible woman. She is a real inspiration and a
oh,
real
I
female
think so
leader,
too.
Isn't
yes.
she?
And I think she's, you know, there have been some bad times in her monarchy, but I think she's taken good advice and has
mm.
adjusted.
Mm.
And
she
she's changed
adjusted.
Her behaviour. If you
yeah.
listen to her speeches in the 60s and you listen to her speaking now and the way she manages a crowd, you know,
yeah.
she's, I think she's
yeah.
done
she's amazing
splendidly to keep
model.
Herself contemporary.
Yeah, she has. Have there been female sergeants of arms who have followed you?
That not the sergeant, but in the team. Yes, ever
okay.
since I was in the team, there have
good.
Been females
good.
In
I'm glad
team.
It didn't begin
no.
and end.
And
you.
Also, they haven't been from military either.
Ah, interesting.
I'm sure there are great people in the military who would do a good job, but that mould is broken as
yeah.
well.
Fantastic.
So,
fantastic.
Pleased, very pleased about
yeah.
that.
So tell us what you're doing now since you...
Well, I do three main things, really, apart from some peripherals. But Beanstalk, the literacy charity, is a big part of what I do. And that's because I'm absolutely passionate about reading, and my children and grandchildren have grown up in a world of books and absolutely love them. And it's quite starkly staggering how many children don't love books and don't have the opportunity to read, perhaps from homes where there's no culture of books. One of the little girls I read with now doesn't read at home at all.
Gosh.
It's very, very sad.
It is.
But Beanstalk's there to help, and it's a very good model. All the volunteers are trained, and there's ongoing training as well. And each of us work with three children.
Right.
You have your own three children.
Right.
And you have a one-to-one with them twice a week. So they have the undivided attention of a non-judgmental adult twice a week. Not many children have that.
No,
you know, when you have your own children, you're doing three or four things at a time, and you might listen to them read, or you might read to them for 10 minutes at bedtime. But I think the secret of it is this undivided attention. And we don't only read. We play games. We talk. We listen to them read, but we read together. We do all sorts of different things. And it's about building their confidence and self-esteem.
Okay.
And the results show that once they become literate, they do better in everything at school.
Of course, because they're confident.
Sport, maths, exactly.
Yeah, because it has a huge impact on your self-esteem and confidence and your ability to be part of something, a participant.
Exactly, and you're doing what everybody else is doing.
So, okay, it puzzles me that the basis of education is that you learn to read and write.
Mm.
So why is Beanstalk needed? What's gone wrong in education that you are needed?
Well, the solution is not more teachers. It's about cultures.
Okay.
So we don't teach the children. We support them in their learning and becoming literate. And they're disadvantaged. The children we work... So if a child is disabled in any way, that it's difficult for them, they get extra support. They have special educational needs. And if they're deprived, they also get extra support. Our children are disadvantaged. So it may be as simple as English as a second language.
Okay.
So there's no English at home.
Okay.
It may be, sadly, single-parent families.
Right.
So there's no time. Maybe that both parents work shifts and there's a lot of children, so they just don't have time. And as I've mentioned, there's the culture of just no books, all on screen.
Mm.
You know, no games, no board games. Not sitting around a table eating together, so no conversation. And I would say, of the session, 10 minutes is conversation.
Mm.
It's getting them to open up and talk and use their imaginations. And, you know, you've got to a good stage when you can say to them, so what do you think is going to happen next? And they can think of something.
Mm.
So it's all about that, opening them up. That's not what a classroom teacher does.
Sure, yeah.
So you can all usually track back to something, which is why they're not up with their peers.
Okay. I mean, I forget, because I don't have children, so I forget how life has changed so dramatically. And I'm still thinking of what it was like when I was at school, which is like 1960s and 1970s. I think it may have changed just slightly, because I can remember the old Imperial typewriters. That we forget that children are brought up almost being able to work a computer when they're still in their nappies, and how technology has taken over all of our lives, but how much it's impacted on children and how children grow up.
Exactly.
Do you think it's detrimental how technology has changed?
Well, I don't think you're ever in 100% situation, so I don't think any child's life is totally ruled by technology. The secret is to get the balance.
The balance, yeah.
You know, we use technology sometimes. It's much more fun looking up a word on someone's phone or iPad to find the meaning than to look in a dictionary.
Okay.
So that enlivens it.
Yeah.
You know, that makes it fun. So it's using technology as a tool to achieve an end.
Yeah.
But the joy of opening a picture book and talking about it, nothing will replace that. And there is, you know, statistics show us through the bookshops and Amazon, all sorts of things, that although there was a swing towards e-reading, it's actually the pendulum is coming back. And it's not a change, but it's a balance.
Yeah.
A balance between the two. But, you know, research, that kids can do research so much more quickly.
Yeah, yeah, true.
and then they can get on with the other things, the other part of it. So I think you have to get the balance right.
Because I remember saying this to my dad when he was dying, and he was talking, and we were talking about, you know, the past and when I was a child. And I said to him, the main thing that stays in my memory, Dad, that you, the biggest gift that you gave me, I said, I can remember I was about 5 and we were in the library in Sidcup in Kent, which is where I grew up. And of course, I was only knee height to a grasshopper, so it appeared huge.
Yes, yes.
You know, these big bookcases that just were like, it's like walking in, like, well, I don't know, like a fairy story with all this. And I can remember walking around, and I can remember him holding my hand and saying, see all these books. And I was going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he said, well, once you've learned, they're full of adventure and excitement and magic. Yeah. And as soon as you learn to read, you can find out all about this magic. Can I? And the excitement that put me into that I was desperate to learn to read so I could unlock all of this magic.
It is magic.
And then I reminded him when I was 50, you know, 45 years later, that gift that he gave me, my love of reading. And he'd completely forgotten he'd said that.
Wow.
But it is instilling that magic in children, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Of adventure and allowing their imagination.
And excitement.
And
wanting to turn the page. Have you heard of Julia Donaldson?
No.
She's a great children. She wrote The Gruffalo.
I've heard of the Gruffalo. Yeah.
But there's an amazing poem she's written, and it starts, I opened a book and in I strode. I left my world behind me. And that's the magic of it.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah.
And this wonderful 95-year-old I was interviewing, and she's written all these amazing books, and I was saying to her, what's your favourite book? She still goes to a book club, so she reads a novel once a fortnight. And she went, I said, Winnie the Pooh. And I just said, I'm with you there.
Yes.
Winnie the Pooh has to be the best book.
It's very often when people are asked that question, it's a childhood book. You know, one of mine is Little Women.
Is it? Yeah.
Which I just loved, and Gone with the Wind. And it's a book you read in those formative years that actually, that I think, sticks with you as a favourite.
Yeah.
And, you know, because I'm a trustee of Beanstalk as well, so you see the national picture the statistics are quite incredible. I think it was last July, 66,000 children left primary school unable to read to the standard required.
Good grief. Yeah.
And that leads on to, in the London riots, 60% of the children who, or the young people who were arrested, were illiterate.
Right.
And then that transposes into prison figures. And the cost of the illiteracy among that population to the country is millions.
So
millions.
How do we tackle this? I mean, Beanstalk obviously does a huge amount, but there are big pushes.
There's Born to Read, which is a collaboration between a number of charities and with government support. And now there is a target that by 2020, every 11-year-old will leave primary school able to read to what they call the required standard.
Right.
And it must be, because if you go to senior school and you're taking on all these new subjects, if you can't read about what they are, you're at a tremendous disadvantage. Mm. So it's to get rid of that disadvantage, which is what we all strive for.
And the stigma as well, that they...
Oh, yes.
Because children, well, we all do. I mean, human beings, we become very, very adept at hiding.
Absolutely.
And pretending
that
we're okay when in fact we're not. So... Yeah. We become very good at pretending we can read and write when in fact we can't. Mm.
Avoidance strategies are
incredible.
If only people would use that brain power that they use for an avoidance strategy into actually applying themselves to read.
I mean, it's just things like basic health and safety. If you can't read, you can't read safety notices, can you?
Well, in a training session, there's a story I tell about, I ask people to follow me over Westminster Bridge, but to close their eyes. So they're walking across Westminster Bridge with their eyes closed, and the Houses of Parliament's on the left, and we get to Big Ben and we turn right down the steps into the underground station. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, now you can open your eyes, but you can't read. So you can't find how to get a ticket, you don't know which platform to go on, you can't see where you're meant to be, what you're meant to be doing. How frightening is that, let alone the social stigma of it?
Mm.
And I say, you know, you can't even look at the Hello magazine and the person next to you, just to lighten it.
Mm.
But it's a heavy burden.
It's very isolating, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Very lonely place
to be. So lots to do, but we're always looking for more volunteers to work with the children. Yeah. But Beanstalk is spreading. We're just about to open in Somerset.
Oh, okay.
In the southwest.
Yeah.
Where there is a great need. We can identify where the need is. And there we're working in collaboration with the... the Wells Book Festival.
Ah, fantastic.
So literary festivals are a great avenue for us to expand our business, and that's one of the strategies we're following this year.
And I don't know if you ever listened to Chris Evans on BBC Radio 2 in the morning with the children.
Yes, and the writing.
Yeah, and the writing. Yes. I mean, what a fantastic initiative that is.
Well, Camilla is patron. Camilla
she's on the judging panel.
She's the patron of Beanstalk.
Oh, is she?
It's so close to her heart.
Oh, fantastic.
For helping children to read. Yeah, she's the patron of Beanstalk.
Fantastic.
So that's amazing that we have that. And through that, children have been to Clarence Howe.
Oh, wow.
We've taken children to Downing Street to meet Samantha Cameron.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, so she's a great supporter as well. So there is massive support and government support as well.
That's good.
So the progress, you know, must accelerate to achieve this 2020 target.
So how did Beanstalk come to be in existence? Was it your brainchild?
No. Beanstalk's been in existence for 40-odd years.
Has it really? Oh, my gosh.
It used to be called Volunteer Reading Help.
Oh, okay.
And the problem was nobody knew about it.
Right.
Until the Evening Standard ran their Get London Reading campaign in the summer before I was going to retire, which is how I read about it. And I thought, oh, this really fits with the kind of thing I want to do. So that's how it came about for me. But it was started by an amazing woman who was in North London and had to deal with ILEO. I don't know if you've heard of ILEO, but it was quite a challenging education authority. And she fought because she could see the problem and what she thought was the solution. Mm. And sitting round a kitchen table with four of her friends, they actually started this charity, must be 42 years
Goodness.
Ago now. And it gradually grew and grew and grew, but it didn't really have a profile until the Evening Standard.
Right.
And they've been amazing. They really have. They gave it the profile. They recognised how poor literacy was across London, recognised that Volunteer Reading Help, as it was then, but Beanstalk now, was the perfect charity delivery partner. Mm. And they raised £500,000.
Wow, fantastic.
To kickstart in London. And it's worked.
And is there anywhere else other than London?
Oh, it's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
No, it's everywhere.
It's UK-wide?
Yes, it's UK-wide. It's a national charity.
Ah, fantastic.
But, the focus became on London because of the Evening Standard.
Because of Standard, yeah.
And now we've used that media partnership to launch in Kent. So there's in Medway, there's a Get Kent Reading campaign. In Leeds, there's a campaign with the Yorkshire Evening Post. So that's quite a good model to partner with a local media organisation
to
kick it off and get it going. Yeah. So no, it's a national charity. So people all over the country can help.
It must be an absolute joy when you see that light bulb of recognition in a child's eyes when they suddenly get it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they can...
I can read.
Yeah,
yes.
Can read. Yes. I mean,
it is amazing.
Joy.
I mean, it's hard work sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
The journey, but it's so worthwhile because you see this happen.
What skills do you need to be a volunteer?
You need a love of books. You don't need to have worked with children or even have children. You need to be quite tenacious. You need to have good interpersonal skills because you need to build a relationship with the school as well.
Right, yeah.
With the teachers.
Course,
it's very much more successful if there's a good relationship between the school and the volunteers. And you need some patience. You need to want to give something back.
I want to give something back.
Yeah.
I think fantastic.
That's the main thing.
So you, in the introduction, we also talked about that you work with entrepreneurs and particularly women to encourage women onto boards.
Yes.
Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, it's not so much onto boards. It's more about SMEs, small to medium enterprises. Although, I mean, I totally support women on boards, but I'm not active in that area. But through the Pink Shoe Foundation, which was started by Helene Martin G, must be. Oh, 8-9 years ago, and she was working in Parliament, and she saw there was a need to support business women who were working there. But also, she's an entrepreneur herself, and had friends and colleagues who were entrepreneurs. So she started this organisation called Pink Shoe Foundation, which I was a founder member of. But obviously, while I was working, I had very little time to enter into it, although I was a great supporter and I would occasionally go along to events in my uniform but carrying a pair of pink shoes in my hands just to show solidarity. But once I retired, I was able to become more active in it, and I chair the Pink Shoe Senate, which is the strategic planning group. And Helene had always wanted to expand, and we'd done quite a lot in the UK.
Right.
But we wanted to up the game and take it internationally.
Okay.
And so we're now have embarked on something called the UK Economic Blueprint for Women-Owned Businesses, which is based on a model in America.
We partner
with an organisation called Women Impacting Public Policy, WIP, which is quite interesting.
Yes, isn't it?
And we partner with them, and they've been on this initiative since 2003.
Right.
And have made a big impact. They've been able to influence policy, but also they've been able to influence corporates to open up contracts for more women, for women-owned businesses. A women-owned business is a business that's owned, led or managed 51% or more by women.
Do you work with We Connect International?
We certainly do. We certainly
who operate
do.
On the
They're
same.
Another partner, yes. And so Maggie Berry is leading our work stream on access
because you've got,
to markets.
Elizabeth in the US who started in the
US. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we have some very good partnerships already for the Economic Blueprint. And we have a 10-point plan.
Yeah.
By 2020, we have 10 key objectives, one of which is that at the moment 19% of businesses are owned by women, only 19%, yet the population is 51%.
Wow.
So you can guess what our target is, to at least get parity, and that's the overarching objective. And then out of that, there are 9 others, and they all fall into the realms of fair access to markets, fair access to capital, fair access to research, and fair access to training. And we have 4 work streams on those lines that are growing and becoming very active. And one of our key partners is the Enterprise Research Centre at Aston University.
Oh, okay.
Because if you haven't got the data,
sure,
how can you say where you are and see
it's
where you're going?
Mentioned, hasn't it?
And they're very active in the whole entrepreneurial enterprise world. But they're working very closely with us and government to get more data by gender.
So what needs to change to have a shift in the culture to encourage more women?
Well, I think it works both sides. There's government departments and there's corporates need to be more open to women businesses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know there's lots of data showing that the contribution by women-owned business to the economy is enormous. But I think there's perhaps slightly closed minds to them. So we need to do some hearts and minds work on opening up. And from the point of view of the women, I think confidence building.
Yeah.
I mean, I think mentoring is a real key for a woman in any position where she's near the top, because it's lonely.
Mm.
You know, the higher you get, the lonelier you are. So having an external mentor is a huge, huge benefit. And there's lots of mentoring happening, but we're not recognising it, and we're not making good matches between the people who really need it and the people who are very good at it. So that's part of our training work stream, is getting the people involved who are leading these mentoring organisations and looking at how we can match better. The Federation of Small Businesses is another partner. They have 200,000 members, 30% of which are women-owned businesses.
Are they? Good.
So, you know, there's a big opportunity there to do some matching there on the mentoring side.
And it is looking at both sides, isn't it?
It is, yes.
I mean, I saw this when I spent a lot, many years working with corporate companies on their gender diversity agenda.
Right.
And I recognised very early on that it was a problem of, two halves. So yes. The corporates absolutely had a responsibility to make sure that their culture, their policies, their guidelines, their practices were gender neutral, because actually that's
absolutely
the ideal.
It shouldn't be
for women or for men. It should be completely gender neutral.
Yeah.
But that wasn't enough, because unless you actually work directly with the women to help them change their attitude about themselves, in other words, to believe that they could do it and stop putting themselves down, not speaking up at meetings, not going for the promotion, allowing other people to, giving an idea to somebody and allowing somebody else to run with it. And not, unless you dealt with that, all the policies and culture shift in the world wasn't going to make any difference.
No.
So it is looking at
this
both
sides.
This
is why we've got long-term goal as well to 2020.
Right.
Because it's not going to change overnight. No. But year on year, we have a conference called the Female Quotient.
Okay.
Which is about this 51%. But we'll accept 50. And we launched, this is where we launched the Economic Blueprint in 2014. So that was FQ1. And then we had FQ2 at the Shard at the Enterprise Research Centre and Warwick Business School partners at their venue there last year, and then this October we should have another one. So to show our progress, to see how we're getting there towards 2020. But you have to work with all sorts of partners in this. It's not just about changing government policy.
No.
Lots of people think it is, but it isn't. No. It's about behaviours, and it's all the key stakeholders in there have got. So, you know, a lot of what we're doing at the moment is raising awareness, creating partnerships. That's Helen and I are working on that side of it. We're very fortunate because we are very close to some of the all-party groups in Parliament.
Right.
So there's the all-party group on entrepreneurship.
Right.
There's the all-party group on women in enterprise. There's an all-party group on small businesses. And they're, you know, they're very, very supportive of what they're doing and working with us. Yes, yes.
They are. Because a lot of, there are APPGs that aren't active. But
well, I don't, you know, but at every election, they all dissolve and have to restart.
Oh, do they?
So at the beginning of a parliament, you get a lot of interest and activity. So if you can harness that, then you gain some momentum. Yes.
Absolutely.
And as you say, anyway, some are more active than others. Yeah. But by dint of what the focus is of these, they are active because it's people with entrepreneurial and enterprise spirit.
Of course, yeah.
So we're very excited about this economic blueprint.
I bet.
Very exciting.
I bet.
And we have a close relationship with WIP in America and also with the European WIL, Women in Leadership.
Ah, okay.
And with another policy group for women in America. So we are sort of getting onto the international stage.
And is the vision with all of these collectively, globally, is to create a global blueprint?
There is a WIP International has been created.
Ah.
And they chose the UK to be their first partner for a pilot. So we are the first.
Fantastic.
But they're now working with people in the Balkans, in India, in South America. They'd picked out zones in the world where they felt this was an issue, but also where they felt they would get some synergy and between them as well. So, so that's moving as well. So that ultimately, it's global.
It is global, isn't it?
We're starting in the UK and making our contribution there. But I think, and the models are interesting because the model transfers in a certain respect, but the cultures are different, the contexts are different. The Americans are more legislative than we are. You know, it's just the British nature and style, and that will be different in India and the Balkans.
Absolutely.
But the basis of it,
the
basis of it will work.
It's very interesting, isn't it? I'm doing some work with women in leadership in India. And, of course, you have such a different culture.
Yes.
Of the, you know, the family culture and the hierarchy there. I mean, we think we have hierarchy over here.
Absolutely.
We know nothing in comparison.
Yes.
So it is interesting when you start to take this work globally that you have to be flexible
to adjust. Yes, you have to adapt accordingly
to the cultures, don't you?
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, it's a real hot topic in India at the moment, in leadership. Huge. Mm. Yeah. What do you think women bring to the entrepreneur table that men don't?
I think they're more open-minded. I think women think out the box much more naturally. I think they're multi-skilled. If you've got a project that's very, very focused, I'd give it to a man. If you want someone to manage a program of projects, I'll give it to a woman.
Interesting, yeah. Because we both have our strengths and weaknesses.
Oh, absolutely. That's why, you know, in Pink Shoe, we're not anti-men in every way. We have quite a few men who are members. Because we think it's about working with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you get all the strengths and skills and you put them together, you're going to achieve much more if it's only men or only women.
Yeah.
So we're very much about mixed around the table.
It's got to be about collaboration
of
going
course,
forward,
and
isn't
teamwork,
it, in the 21st
yes,
century?
Absolutely.
And you know, we want respect from men, but we also have to give them the respect. And one of the things that causes me a huge amount of pain is when I hear women bad-mouthing men in the corporate world.
Absolutely, me too.
And then mirroring all of their bad behaviour.
Of course, yes.
You
of
know,
course
it's,
they do.
It's got to be about collaboration and also women supporting women, because historically that hasn't always happened.
No, it hasn't, because it's been so cutthroat to get there.
But it's been
difficult. Hasn't been supportive, which is why women need mentors.
Yeah.
And to understand
really
that you're not really in competition with each other.
No.
You're all aiming for the same
and thing. It's coming out of head-based fear, isn't it?
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Heart-based collaboration.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think generally as a race, we're very much led by fear, which keeps us very protective, very competitive in the wrong way, because competitive.
It's quite interesting. There are statistics among SMEs that will show you that a man will go on growing his business until about 10 million. And then he'll probably think, well, I've done quite well here. I'm either going to sell it or expand it. A woman will get to 5 million and stop.
Really? Mm. How yes. interesting.
It is, isn't it? It's.
Yeah.
I think women are still risk averse, generally. There are a few who are not, but generally women are still risk averse. And you feel you've got to be really, really good.
Mm.
Because if you fail, someone will be on your back.
Mm.
Whereas if a man fails, his mates will say, oh, it's okay, pick yourself up and on you go again. And we've got to get over that. We've got to get through that.
And it is also thinking and remembering, isn't it? It's a bit like walking up a mountain. If you're halfway up the mountain and you're looking at the top thinking, oh, lordy, 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 I've got so far to go, I'm never going to get there. What we forget to do is pause, turn around and look at how far we've
yes,
come.
Yes, exactly.
And it's
yes.
really important to remember just how far we've come. You know, the things that I take for granted as a woman in the world today were not even on the radar screen for my mother, let alone my grandmother.
Well, that's what I see for my daughters.
Yeah.
You know, the things that are quite natural for them weren't in my world when I was starting out my career. And yet the things that they quite rightly expect to be in place weren't on my horizon.
So we have to remember how far
we do.
We do,
definitely.
Without taking our eye off the ball of
where we're going to get to.
The peak of that mountain is getting closer and closer.
Yes, I think that's true. But I also, this thing about the glass ceiling, the interesting thing about a glass ceiling is you can't see it.
Yeah,
so you never actually know where it is.
Yeah,
so sometimes you've done it and you don't realise.
You don't realise you're throwing it out the other side.
And I think that was the case with me when I became sergeant. You know, people kept saying to me, "I said, yeah, I suppose I have really." And I think I particularly wanted to do it for all women.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't just for me. You know, I wanted the job, but I wanted the job not because I was a woman. And I always remember when I very first went to House of Commons, Betty Boothroyd was speaker. Who's one of my great role models. And she took me around her state apartments, and on the way we were chatting and she said, I hope very much that you feel you got the job because you were the best person and not only because you were a woman. And that has stayed with me.
Yeah.
And I did feel that. Yeah. I did feel that.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jill. That's a great way to end, because that has to be successful business. It has to be that you are the best person for the job, regardless of anything.
That's right. So it becomes gender neutral in the end, which is where we should be.
Brilliant. Yeah. Thank you for being a joy.
It's been my pleasure. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So you've been listening to Katie Day and Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.